down to the business of the presentations and timekeeping.
So I just wanted to start by thanking Lisa for hosting the event today, and particularly Tendish has been great with allowing us to host it in this room. Where the idea for this seminar came from was we weren't really sure where Romanian studies fits today in kind of European studies, post-communist studies, between kind of Southeastern Europe and Poland, Czech Republic and Hungary. We know that it's kind of different to all these states, but that means in a sense it doesn't really have a home. So we wanted to have an event that was looking at the Romanian elections specifically to ask the question about where we're kind of going to go in the post-Băsescu era.
Great. And I would like to say it's very nice to be at an event where people are actually researching real places, because sometimes my field of politics is going the direction of I'm not really sure what they're researching. Is it real or not real? So therefore, let's get down to some facts. Now, I just have a few explanations for the presenters. Because we're such a packed room and I really want to get to discussion, I'm going to be very harsh with time. So I know we were thinking 10 to 15 minutes, but I'd like to encourage you to stick to 10. And to help encourage you, I have a penalty card system. So when you reach 8 minutes, you'll get the yellow card. When you reach 10 minutes, you get the red card. I almost brought a whistle, my husband suggested, but I left it at home. But I might stand up if you go far over time, so that would be quite disruptive. So there you are. And I'll try to keep the time as best as I can on my phone. If anyone thinks that I've been unfair with the timing, no, sorry, I'm doing my best with my phone. It doesn't have the seconds. So with that, so yes, I am going to be quite severe. I'd first like to turn to Dan Brett, who along with Ellie Knott organized this event. And Dan is an associate lecturer at the Open University, both in arts and humanities and in social sciences. So he's sort of fitting this idea that we're not really sure where our home is, spreads himself around. Okay, there you go.
Okay, so as somebody who kind of straddles all positions, I'll try and give some sort of a context and introduction to sort of, you know, the election. And what I really want to sort of think about is this kind of sense of crisis from crisis, and argue that a lot of trying to understand what's gone on, why we had this surprise result, we actually sort of almost need to step back and look at the sort of the more medium term process, and really sort of thinking about the impact of the economic crisis and the way in which politics has played out since the economic crisis. So obviously we had the 2008 economic crisis, and many of Romania's economic problems can really be attributed to the very lax economic policies that the Terechani government employed from 2004 to 2007. 2009, Băsescu is elected, despite the crisis, Băsescu is elected for a second term, beating Mircea Joana in a very closely fought election. The interesting point is that Băsescu's former allies in the PNLA tell their supporters to back Joana, but not Băsescu, and there is this sense very early on from the PSD that the election was stolen by the diaspora and that these were the people who were responsible. The upshot of it is that Joana gets replaced by Victor Ponta shortly after the election defeat. Ponta is seen, and there he obviously is with Iliescu, Joana and Năstase, is seen very much as being as a protege of Adrian Năstase, but he's seen in some ways as also being different. He's seen as almost being the new generation. He's somebody who doesn't have a background in the Romanian Communist Party, as all the other previous PSD leaders had done. So what we have is we have a situation where anti-corruption efforts are starting to threaten vested interests, particularly the PSD, and there's obviously growing concern about that. And we see that the what had started out as really being a sort of informal alliance between the PNLA and the PSD in the run-up to the election actually becomes much more formalised, and the creation of the USLA. The agreement basically is driven by the fact that they both hate Băsescu, but they agree that once that they divide offices, that Ponta will become Prime Minister and Antonescu will be the presidential candidate. And with this, they agreed to work together. They worked together in the 2012 elections against Băsescu. So we then have really the sort of fallout of the economic crisis that sort of takes a couple of years to kick in. So by 2011, Băsescu, for a populist, is a remarkably unpopular populist. He displays a particular tin ear to, you know, when one considers a populist, one thinks of somebody who has his ear to the, you know, to the will of the people, but he displays a remarkable tin ear. So what we see is we have the IMF loan, the imposition of austerity measures and things like this, and this then prompts a wave of protests against health privatisation, against ACTA, against the austerity measures, against environmental issues and things like this. At this point, the USLA jumps on every single bandwagon that's going. There you go. If it's, you know, if Băsescu is in favour of Rusia Montan, they're against it. If Băsescu is in favour of health privatisation, they're against it. And basically, they, you know, they're willing to get, you know, on any thing. Essentially, the USLA then works to bring down both the BOC and then the Hungary army governments. And here we start to see some of the protests. And one of the things, again, I think that's quite interesting from these sorts of things is the sense of generation and so on and so forth. Okay. And again, but also the sense that the protesters were aware of how the USLA was using it and this kind of response of, you know, well, actually, you know, our protest is not your electoral campaign. Okay, so the USLA comes to power, sweeps to power in the local election of 2012. They come to power immediately, attempt to impeach Băsescu, all the while the economic crisis is going on. At this point in time, the USLA and Ponta completely reverses all their positions, having opposed austerity, they then stopped. They welcome fracking, they welcome Chevron, they fudge the Russia-Montana issue. They start to show during the impeachment some fairly sort of strongly anti-democratic and quite authoritarian tendencies. But also, and here we see, you know, Ponta during the floods, sort of very much positioning himself as almost sort of president in waiting. There's, you know, lots of him in the media, you know, pointing, very sort of Kimmel Sun type sort of thing. The upshot of basically, so what then happens is that it becomes very clear that Ponta is positioning himself to run for the presidency despite the agreement with the USLA, or with the PNLA. So, having Antonescu having sort of thrown his weight behind the USLA in the belief that this would allow him a free run at the presidency, then suddenly he finds that actually he's been kind of pretty much, you know, pushed to the side. The USLA breaks down, Antonescu withdraws his ministers, Ponta meanwhile has a united party behind him, he has the prestige and things like this. We see a battle emerge within the centre-right to oppose Ponta, we see a battle within the PNLA, we see a battle within the PDLA. There's an inability to agree on the candidate, Antonescu doesn't win the PNLA selection, nor does Terechanu, and instead Iohannis is chosen. Terechanu chooses to run as an independent. Meanwhile, Băsescu chooses, for reasons that are best known to himself, but there's a more salacious point to his interest in Mrs. Udrea, for splitting the PDLA and basically rather than backing somebody like Ungureanu. Meanwhile, Monica McAvey chooses to run as an independent. So there, it must be said, doing a Google search for pictures of Băsescu and Udrea does produce some rather hilarious results. There are... That seems to just be his permanent expression when he sees her. And so the upshot is that this is the electoral field for 2014, which is the largest since 92. As we see, you know, four centre-right candidates, three far-right candidates, independents, and so on and so forth. So the big questions before the first round were essentially who would finish second behind Ponta. Would we have a rerun of 2000 where we had whereby the centre-right imploded to such extent that we had a freak result finishing second when Vadim Tudor finished second? Would we end up in another situation where we suddenly end up with Ponta or Dandia Canescu? What the hell would we do then? Interestingly, Ponta's very early theme here, he talks about sort of again very, very populist, promising anything and everything from unification with Moldova to 400 football pitches, very much aimed at sort of mobilising the base. We see again this kind of distribution of EU food for pensioners, very carefully positioned under a Vote Ponta poster. We also see, at this point in time, Ponta threatening more political instability, talking about, well, when he wins the presidency, the first thing he's going to do is impeach Băsescu again, suspend him. First round, again, we'll go through these very, very quickly, but we end up with Ponta with a 10-point lead over Iohannis. and the electoral map showing obviously fairly clear division between sort of the west and the southeast. Okay, so the second round, one of the main problems was the problems with the polling of the diaspora. We get the behaviour of the embassies. The London embassy, for example, didn't exactly cover itself in glory. So basically, the problem is that Iohannis faces this. He's got no charisma. He's not a populist, which is quite unusual for Romania. Every other president has been a populist. Ponta really starts to reinforce nationalism with orthodoxy and things like this. He really dominates the campaign on the ground. And then, you know, when I was just in Cluj last week, sort of I would estimate 25 Ponta posters to one Iohannis poster. He's busy offering offices to the far right, the centre right. He's offered, well, he seems to offer prime ministership to about 10 different people. PSD is fairly obviously very toxic, but there's no moment. There's no single moment, like, for example, the Băsescu and the Stasi debates where they talk about, you know, communism and things like this. But what we do see is massive mobilisation both abroad and at home about, you know, against Ponta and things like this. Okay, and but we see both polling and media predicting an easy Ponta victory. The upshot is that Iohannis wins and wins by a fairly comfortable margin in the end. And so just to sort of finish up very, very quickly, some sort of questions that we can sort of move on. Yeah, why did the media and polling get it so wrong? Does this really represent Romania moving beyond ethno-nationalism? How long will the incumbent Ponta government last? Yeah, will Iohannis be able to build any... Given how fragmented the centre-right is, how will Iohannis be able to establish a stable parliamentary report? What will happen to the PSD? You know, bear in mind that it hasn't won an election other than 2000 since 92. You know, where does this go for populists? Will there, given that there's been no alternative centre-right or extreme-right parties, and the effects of austerity, can a centre-left emerge? We obviously had things like the Moldovan elections yesterday, which I think can fairly safely nail the coffin in the dead about whether or not there's any hope of reunification or whatever. Corruption and reform. And one other thing that's worth mentioning, going back to the protests, one of the things that was said quite often was that those people who were involved in the mobilisation back in Romania in the weeks up to the election were people who had cut their teeth on the environmental protests and the anti-austerity protests in 2012. They used the skills and the networks that had emerged for Roșia Montană and things like this, and they were using those same networks to really support mobilise people. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for setting a good example of time. Now we'll move on to Dr. Radu Cimpoieș, who's in the politics department at Kingston University. There you are.
Thank you very much. Well, I suppose what I'm going to do is try to take over from where Dan left it, at least in some respect. And what strikes me is that over the past 2 weeks, I've read probably over 20 analyses of the post-elections in Romania, and here we are trying to sort of add to that. What I'm going to do, given the short time, is just be oversimplistic in some respect, but pose some questions and see where that takes us. And I'm starting from the outcome itself, because what we saw immediately after the results came out is a situation of elation, new beginning. We took our country back. Everything is fantastic, but now what? And there are various stages in the process, and I think the now what question is the really important one. It seems that the elections were carried out in the framework of a battle between democracy and non-democracy. And this is something that needs to be put into context. And I suppose the context is the previous elections, presidential elections. If we look at the results, we see quite a significant match. Not only that, I deliberately selected a quote from former Prime Minister, and I suppose we can add a few other titles, him, Adrian Stase, who pointed out upon losing the 2004 presidential elections that apparently there are two Romanias, there's kind of a rural one and so on, that's voted for him, and there's a more urban one that voted for, at the time, Băsescu. And I'm trying to pick up the theme of the two Romanias and ask, well, are there really two Romanias? And where does that take us? Because a lot of what has happened in the current elections, I'm taking the 2012, Dan, as a kind of reference point, but it is worth going through the whole shebang, as Dan has done, 2008 onwards and so on. But 2012, what we see is the impeachment referendum, and the debate then suffers a very extreme polarization. What we see is the Ponta and Antonescu versus Băsescu, and sort of the USL versus the PDL. What comes out of that encounter, is also another division between Romanians in Romania and those in the diaspora. And various ideas are being thrown around at the time, including people like Crin Antonescu suggesting at the time that maybe we should go for some sort of a preferential voting system whereby those people who kind of haven't lived here, maybe they shouldn't really have the right to have a serious say in what's going on in the country. That to me kind of smacks of Salam Kusoya debate all over again. The other sort of slightly sort of more dangerous, I suppose, discussions taking place at the time about introducing sort of various other forms of restricted voting. And that comes out of that polarization, because the language used at the time in the debate is that of the Oteviști, Băsiști, Populiști versus so on and so forth. So that's the language. It's extremely sort of visceral in nature, and it does point to very sort of clear-cut polarization, points to the extremes. And if we look at what happens now, to me, this seems the 2012 Reloaded. The basis of the debate is exactly the same. Okay, some of the actors may have changed. Crin Antonescu is not in the USL anymore, and so on. He's relatively quiet, I suppose, to be fair to him, as far as Iohannis's campaign went. But that's a different issue. But what comes out in the debate is the anti-Băsescu group and the anti-Ponta group. And that is the nature of the electoral sort of contest. That is problematic in a number of for a number of reasons, I suppose. Because they do gloss over some divisions, and they do kind of enhance some divisions, and they do push forward a discourse of intolerance, a divisive discourse, and a marginalizing discourse. And that's kind of the theme that I'm trying to focus upon. If we look at the Ponta camp, or the anti-Băsescu camp, and I'm not necessarily focusing here specifically on campaign aspects, although a large part of it has to do with the campaign itself, we see kind of the usual tendencies that populists kind of employ in elections. When everything else fails, bring on the church in the debate. Manipulate, use it for electoral purposes. When everything else fails, bring up the nationalism issue, either sort of in terms of casting it internally, ethnic minority issues to do with the fact that Iohannis is not a true Romanian, and so on and so forth. External issues to do with the interference of foreign powers. Of course, Iohannis is sold to, I don't know, depending on where you look, either Germany or the US or both at the same time, and so on. And another aspect has to do with the public spending cuts. But that actually is very specifically targeted, which suggests again that the contest is anti-Băsescu rather than anti-Iohannis as such. It has to do with the measures implemented by the Boc government about reducing public sector salaries by 20% and so on. So it plays on these kinds of fears. What we see on the other side of the barricade, it's a slightly more sort of positive campaign per se from Iohannis. But what happens in the background is to some extent equally divisive. What we see on the one hand is kind of capturing back the diaspora. Although, again, it was not long ago that Crin Antonescu suggested we should kind of divorce from the people who went abroad, or at least limit their ability to participate in elections based on whether they pay tax or not, and so on. Now it has been rallied to the cause. The campaign is largely sort of focusing on its urban appeal and the new media. I don't think the picture there is the most up-to-date one in terms of how many likes Iohannis has currently on Facebook, but it's at the point where kind of it exceeded the million bit, apparently the most popular politician on Facebook.
In Europe,
thank you very much. fair enough. But in terms of the divisions, and in terms of sort of the marginalisation, what we see is the clear anti-Pessedin, anti-corruption discourse, but also much more broadly anti-communism one, which begs questions about what sort of is regarded these days as being communist. Now, if we see that this is the basis upon which the campaign was structured, what happens then is, on the one hand, is targeting traditional divisions, ethnic, religious, nationalist, and so on, and on the other hand, sort of demonization of specific categories of people, and a process of delegitimizing those specific categories of people in terms of their participatory rights. And this is something that I think is slowly coming out in various analyses following the elections. It's about those who shouldn't be voting. It's about go hide your grandmum's ID so that she doesn't vote for Ponta. This is the nature of the discourse. It's visceral politics that highlights social divisions. And when the elation and everything else is sort of going, we should kind of ask ourselves what's left behind. Now that the thrill is gone, as it were, there is the slow realization that the results actually do point to a framework of cohabitation. And there are important questions about what will come out of that, whether we'll have early elections next year, whether we wait for 2016, and what the framework, as Dan has pointed out, is going to be in terms of what the players are going to be at that point. There is no cohesive centre-right party, and we should be under sort of no illusion that Johannes' electorate in this election is a cohesive bloc. And because of this divisive campaign, the polarised campaign, what we see, I suspect, in the short term is that these gaps, these sort of lines of division are going to reappear prominently. And also, they're going to expose the fragility of this post-enthusiasm stage. We already see that to some extent in terms of what's happening at the moment, in terms of Johannes's choices for his team, in terms of the battles that's going on for the leadership of the PNLA and so on. So these are relevant issues to bear in mind. But what seems, I suppose, more important in the broader sense is these lines of division that have been exploited and pushed on quite significantly. The issue of the ethnic division may potentially play out in the midterm, because currently the UDEMRE has repositioned itself as a potential coalition partner, and that will undoubtedly alienate at least a segment of those people who voted for Johannes. But what's perhaps more important is the other social divisions, is the dominance of a very, very strong anti-leftist discourse that leaves no room for debate about issues to do with social justice and so on. And what this does is kind of disenfranchise a large segment of the population in Romania. Those dubbed Babe, Bețivi, Asistat Social, Țigan, Leneș, Needucat, and so on. And a lot of public figures, trendsetters, I suppose, if you want to call them, in Romania, sort of push that kind of language. I suppose one can sort of mention the recent interventions of Mândruță, or what Patapievic is writing these days. What the GDSE does, I suppose, in terms of social dialogue, that actually leaves no room for discussion about the left. And these are areas of concern that are going to be sort of pushed forward. So out of this continuous polarization, I suppose, my question is, do we really have two Romanias, or actually quite a few that bank on various cleavages from education, sex, age, rural, urban divisions, and so on? And what do we do about these things? Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. And now on to Dr. Emanuel Coleman. Coleman, did I say it right? Yeah.
That's fine.
No, that's not right. How do you really
Coleman.
Say it?
Coleman.
Okay. Department of Politics at Oxford University.
Thank you for having me here. Thank you for being here. It's a full room. I haven't seen that probably ever. And my talk is a little bit different from the main theme of the seminar. It's something that's been bugging me since the elections. How could we get it so wrong? How could the opinion polls have it so wrong before the elections? And this is just a very, very brief presentation of very few. I have another slide, but more detailed opinion polls. Before the first one is before the first round, in a hypothetical situation in which Ponta and Yohannis went to the runoff. The second one is between the two elections. The third one is the exit polls, which on average was kind of a tie, right? Some of them gave Ponta as a winner, some of them gave Yohannis. And the final results, which are completely, completely opposite. There's got to be something really, really big happening here. Now, if you think in context, in the context of Romanian polling, that's not really new. And that's Mircea Joanu with his famous Mihaela Dragoscamia speech. He went to bed on election day as a president and woke up as a commoner. Because some of the opinion polls gave him, most of them gave him as a winner, but within the range of error. And actually, there's a clear explanation for the results of 2009. It was diaspora, right? The vote outside of Romania explains that. And if you look at the votes only within Romania, actually, Joanu won by a very, very slim margin. So there's a clear explanation for what happened in 2009. Now, it's very hard to explain these things. It's probably common knowledge for most of us that polls in Romania are very, very biased. Depending on who pays them, they give a couple of percents to one party or the other. And the one in red are those close to PSD, according to my information. There might be debates. So they gave, but most of them gave Ponta as a clear winner. And actually, I forgot to put another survey from November 11, actually the last one, before the elections, which was, it's right there, November 10, and it's clear, even IRES, which is not, according to many sources, is not a biased survey, gave Ponta as the clear winner. So, possible answers. Before I started researching, and I'm going to be very honest with this, very preliminary research, and I can come up with answers, but I'm very honest, I have no idea. On average, what actually happened, and it's really hard to explain. Two possible answers. There's been some really bad sampling before the elections that had to do with, obviously, what changed from one election to the other is the huge turnout compared to the first one. So there's an increasing turnout, and it may be a certain type of voters that are more likely to vote for Yohannis that haven't been sampled to the extent they should have been in the polls before that. That's the most obvious answer, but as we will show, that actually doesn't quite work. Or there's got to be something on election day or right before the election day that actually made these people change their minds, because the difference is just huge between what we have in the opinion polls and actually what happened on election day. So I'm going to start with what happened actually between the two electoral rounds. And I'm pretty sure you're more familiar than I am with the terrible organization of the polls in London and everywhere abroad. And what is most important, it actually becomes a very salient issue at home. There are a lot of protests in cities, especially in Transylvania, which was heavily for Yohannis in the first round. And according to PSD, it was a sort of a made-up issue. And I sort of agree with that. It was made up. But what's the really big problem is whether it's made up or not. It's important, and the PSD doesn't do anything about it. It's, on the contrary, they really regarded all these protests with quite, how should I say, with disdain for all the protesters in the street. And who was blamed responsible? It was Ponta, the prime minister. He was in charge of organizing these voting polls abroad. And the response is very poor. The foreign minister resigns, Titus Corlețean, and he's replaced with somebody, how should I put it? He was put in place, Meleșcani, only to be fired. They knew that, and he probably knew what he was getting into. It was pretty obvious that he was put in there to not do anything. Now, another thing that happens between the two elections, there are two presidential debates, but it's pretty clear that it did not help Yohannes. That's a poll after the first debate. 70% of those interviewed believe Ponta won the debate. I watched the first debate. It was painful as a Yohannes supporter. It was quite painful, and it was primarily the fault of his staff. They didn't negotiate the questions. There are a lot of things that staffs do beforehand in all countries. They didn't do any of that. They just sent him there with no defense. There's also very strong mobilization on social media, and it was already mentioned that Yohannes is very popular on Facebook, and right now he has like 1.2 or something million. He's just a very popular person, despite being, how should I put it? I'm a big fan of Yohannes, let's put it that way, but he's not the very charismatic guy, let's face it. I'm pretty sure that I'm not the only one who's a fan of Yohannes and who voted for Yohannes in this room. But he's just not that kind of charismatic guy, and yet he does very well with young people and with people who have access to this social media. Now, what happens on election day? There may be, we may have the answer to our puzzle on what happened in election day. So, as basic rules, there's no campaigning on TV or any other ways. There are exit polls at 9 p.m. Before that, nobody can actually make public, no TV station can make public any exit polls so that they don't influence the elections because there's no campaigning. But also, the parties usually run internal polls throughout the day, so they have a really good idea how the elections are going at different times. And also, based on that, to mobilize, to carry more people with a bus or whatever that you do, based on how the results go. I do believe, just as a parenthesis, that the whole bus thing is exaggerated. You really don't win elections that way. No matter how well you do it, it's like you need a lot of votes, but that's just a parenthesis.
And we can debate that.
Exactly. It's just not worth it. Okay, so what happened on election day? And I happened to be actually in Romania. There was no campaigning, but the TV stations showed at all time huge, even larger queues in the diaspora. So the issue became even more salient. And on top of that, it was just plain terrible response on election day from the members of the government. And I have two examples. One of them is our favorite Claudio Melechanu, who recommends people in Paris to go vote to Nancy, which is a beautiful city with beautiful weather and the cradle of Art Nouveau. Nancy is like nearly 400 kilometers away. Right? Jesus. Okay, the other example, Gabriella Fira, showed a video of a polling station that was empty near London, which was actually in Liverpool. Within 5 minutes on Facebook, this came out as like, this is false, this is a lie. These people are just not aware of what's going on. So, let's see what the party-run polls tell us. There's a clear pattern that Yohannes became president later on in the day. And we'll see why that's the case. These are the exit polls at 9 o'clock, which basically show a tie. But the same pattern comes up... How's the laser? In ERES that showed, I have data for 7 o'clock, but also 9. All these polls, exit polls, are based on what happened at 7 o'clock. So that explains part of the puzzle why actually the final results are different from the exit polls. Yohannes became increasingly popular as the day went by, and we'll see why. And especially since from 7 to 9, he actually won the... It's more like from 5:30 to 9, he actually won the presidency. Now, does change in age distribution? It's also very clear that younger people voted later. Now, is it because they were mobilized on election day, or is it just because they vote later on a Sunday afternoon when they're probably hungover, as opposed to the old people who just wake up and go to vote? And that's what explains actually the evolution of the vote. Now, how did participation by age was changed? from November 2nd to November 16th. And it's actually no clear pattern that would explain the bad sampling, the first hypothesis they put up front. All age categories, this is based on ERES surveys, just increase their participation. I don't see a clear pattern that the young people were more likely to vote in the second election than the first one. Also, so this is the age distribution of the electorate, the percentages by age population is basically no difference between November 2nd and November 16th. So the poor sampling hypothesis, I don't think is supported. Also, education is roughly the same. You have more people with college, but also more people with no high school who are more likely to vote for Ponta, right? So the young and the more educated voted primarily for Yohannes. The older and less educated voted for Ponta, but it's clear, there's no clear pattern, at least with the data that I have so far. The third hypothesis that may explain the bad sampling, I added a slide on the bus. I forgot to edit. Also, I computed the participation from Transylvania, which was in the first round voted primarily with Yohannes and everyone else, and whether there's a change, a clear pattern that people from Transylvania were more likely to go to the polls, it's basically the same thing. And Sherry can tell you, she can see the graph. The increase in percentage-wise in Transylvania was 22%, whereas the rest of the country was 20-point-something%. So it's no clear pattern that would explain that huge difference. So tentative conclusion. Sampling errors cannot fully explain the results. I cannot say that. I'm pretty sure it doesn't. The vote problems in diaspora were the single most important issue for voters, and I base this on a recent report by Vasile Dimku, who, although he's a pessimist, is a decent one and actually a good sociologist. He's a good sociologist, but he's still avoiding the question of why they got it so wrong, and I think it's a really important question. Why the wrong opinion polls? The diaspora issue may have acted on all voters on election day. That's something that I'm still going to struggle with in the future. There must be something on election day that happened. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And now we'll hear from Roxana Mihaila from Sussex University Department of Politics.
I'll have to say before I start that I'm the odd man out of this table, and you'll understand why in a few minutes. And I liked the question that Ellie started with as to where we fit Romania in the university department. And I think what I'm here to do is to prove that we could fit it in the European Studies department if we try a little hard. And what I thought I'd do today is actually take you through what Yohannes has pledged in his program. It was one of the best well-written programs that I've seen in a while. It's very well-structured in terms of the EU. It's absolutely overwhelming if you even dare for a few seconds to think that it will happen. Because if it does, then Romania is going to be right up there with the top member states in the European Union. I'm going to explain really quickly the conspicuous absence of a PowerPoint behind me. There are two reasons for that. One, first, I knew that I couldn't compete with any of these people on the pictures, because really, they got the best pictures. The EU doesn't have one, any. So that was part of it. The second one was that I was trying to actually come up with a PowerPoint presentation, and I realized that about half of my slides would have one line on them, and it looked downright depressing. And then, coming to think of it, I thought, well, it's actually a very good metaphor for the role that the EU has played in the campaign and in Romanian politics in general. And I'm going to structure this presentation into two parts. First of all, I'm going to look at the role of the EU in the campaign and then at what Yohannes' victory means for the EU. First part, very short. You've seen from the previous presentations that they were too busy making promises and they were too busy arguing about who's the most incompetent in the history in order to actually be able to represent the country or to be able to do anything as far as the EU was concerned. In the first round, there was very little of the debate that touched on EU issues. Most of it, we go back to the same pattern that we see when we talk about European Parliament elections. It's that valence issue, the EU as a valence issue. Who has done best or worst on EU issues? Who can take this further or not? So that's the extent of the degree that you would see a debate on it. In between the two campaigns, they were too busy debating the role of the diaspora and the votes and understanding pretty much what was going on to actually take on EU issues seriously. Of course, we do talk about things like austerity politics. We talk about enlargement. We talk about economics, but in a very general framework. There's very little debate per se. And that takes me to the second part. And the second part the program at least shows that there's potential for change. And I like in particular one of his quotes, there was somewhere in the middle, that said that Romania will graduate from the EU integration school and become a mature, strong, and respected EU state. Now, as grand statements go, this is one of the best. So if you break it down, and he did actually address everything punctually, it does make sense. He has some very clear milestones set up with specific targets, specific measures. So on paper, it works. And I'm just going to give you a few brief examples. Before that, however, what matters is that we have a fresh face at the EU level. He comes with very little baggage, a carry-on at the most compared to everyone else. He's non-charismatic as he is well-liked on the international level. He has developed a series of bilateral relations with Germany in particular, although I sense that might actually turn against him at one point or another. He's already being attacked on all fronts for being a favorite of the EPP and a puppet, Merkel's puppet, and so on and so forth. But, nothing that you wouldn't expect. So let's just work with the assumption for now that this is a plus for him, the fact that he has developed these relationships. He's a credible figure at the EU level. And after the debacle in the summer of 2012 and after they fought over, you will remember the fight about who is constitutionally entitled to represent Romania at the European Council, the president versus the prime minister. I think everyone is happy now and relieved that the person goes to Brussels now is non-charismatic as he is, he's serious enough. He has a clear agenda. And I think the way he's perceived at the EU level might change just a little bit. Now, I said that I was going to look very quickly at a few of the things that he's promised in terms of the EU. And he has put front and center the idea of the council presidency in 2019. Romania is taking over in the second semester. And his goal by then would be to actually ensure that it, not only that it graduates, but also that it transforms into a member state that deserves its place in the European Union and that actually gets to have a role that's proportionate with its size, with its capacity. It's in the top 7 member states in the EU, if you look at the population, if you look at resources. And what the only area where it lacks is leadership. And that's where he might be able to change something. So in terms of the council presidency, 2019, priorities there would be, as you'd expect, the questions of absorptions of EU funds, administrative capacity to actually be able to take national positions to the European level. And here I read a very interesting proposal, but which has a very problematic word within it. And he said that he would like that the Romania's national position should reflect the national interest as agreed by consensus between the president, the government, the opposition, and civil society. Now, we all know enough about Romanian politics to know that consensus is probably the most problematic word in that sentence. And that's the problem with most of this plan. Each and every one of these measures comes back to the idea of cooperation. After yesterday, especially, you'd expect Moldova to be on the map. And he's declared it a national priority. That, by definition, should mean that Romania will take a prominent role as far as enlargement is concerned. Finally, something that I thought was very interesting in the way he phrased it was the issue of absorption of EU funds. And he wants, he's very much into restructuring. He pretty much wants to restructure the entire way we do politics in the country. And he also wants to restructure the way we deal with EU funds. So there will be a special unit cooperating directly with Brussels. Everything should work fine. The only problem here is he's planning to have a group of elite civil servants that would know what they're doing, would be in charge of monitoring the implementation and the accession of EU funds. Now, what he wants to do here is the manner in which they're going to be remunerated is based on the actual degree of absorption of EU funds, which, as far as meritocracy goes, I think is the first time that I've actually seen something so extreme, really, if you want to put it. So I'm very interested to see how this plays along, if this actually goes anywhere. Right. And finally, in general, we should expect a much more pronounced role for the country in external relations. He's put it out there on the map. We should take that the country should take advantage of its geographic location, about its role in the European neighborhood, and so on and so forth. And I'm going to wrap it up here by going back to the idea of consensus. All this sounds excellent on paper. Whether or not he'll be able to put it into practice, I think it's the same question that everybody has asked tonight. What will happen with the parties? Is Ponta going to be as docile as he's been so far? I might be the glass half empty, but I'm still sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop to see what happens after this reflection period will have been over. So I'll leave it here. Thank you.
And next is Ellie Knott, who's looking for the...
Yeah.
She's in the Department of Government at LSE.
Okay, so if Roxana thinks she's the odd one out, I'm definitely the odd one out, because I'm not even really talking about Romania so much. I'm much more talking about the relationship between Romania and Moldova from the perspective of the Moldovan electorate. And the question that interests me is, how are Moldovans voting in Romanian elections? Why are they making these preferences? And the kind of bigger puzzle about extraterritorial politics. Because we don't really know that much about elections beyond nation states. We kind of think that they're constrained by nation state borders. But actually what we see in Romania is, in a sense, an anomaly. Because in parliamentary elections, there are external constituencies. So when Moldovans are voting in parliamentary elections, they're not voting for constituencies within Romania. They have their own constituencies within Europe. So I think that the issue of Moldovans voting in Romanian elections is an important issue and is going to grow in importance, which leads me to kind of my second area of interest, which is, what is the relationship between what I see is an increasingly facilitated push from the Romanian state for Moldovans to reacquire Romanian citizenship. I'm not talking about acquisition, I'm talking about redomandire, so the right that they're, the idea that they're getting back some right that their grandparents lost. What is the relationship between that policy and elections? And how do citizens become voters in Romanian elections? So I start with a puzzle, which I think fits quite well into something that's been discussed more widely, which is the idea of unification. So why are we still talking about unification 25 years after it didn't happen? Well, 23 years after it didn't happen. And so when Ponta was making his statements about the second great unification, I was struck with a puzzle. Was he talking to voters within Romania, or was, which is my own bias because I'm interested in Moldova, was he talking more broadly to the kind of the electorate that would be voting in Romanian elections within Moldova? And why might he be talking to them? Well, in 2009, they voted overwhelmingly for Băsescu, and this is something that has come up before about the diaspora vote and kind of tipping the balance from a Giana win to a Ponta Băsescu win. And this is something that was quite prevalent in the people that I was interviewing in Moldova, this idea that we won the election for Băsescu. I think that's slightly overplaying it. We're only talking about 11,000 people in the second round. But there's still this idea and this kind of connection between Băsescu and the Moldovan electorate, in particular because he's seen as the guy that really facilitated their right to acquire Romanian citizenship more easily. And so when we're looking beyond 2009 to 2014 in an era post-Băsescu, the question is, firstly, where do the votes go and how do we tap into those votes? And what we see over time is a steady kind of increase, both in the number of voters within Moldova in Romanian elections and also in terms of the polling booths. So the red line is the number voting in Moldova, and we see even between the second and first round a massive increase. It kind of doubles between the second and first round. And again, it's doubled since 2009. Because in the early 2000s, we're only talking about a couple of thousand people. But now we're talking about 36,000 people, which is actually quite a significant number, particularly when we look at how polling stations might increase going forward, and that's something I'll come back to in the end of the presentation. And in general, we also see this trend in the number of diaspora voting, which has massively increased between the second and first round in 2014. But actually what's interesting is that the number of polling stations isn't increasing so much in relation to the diaspora increasing. So if we go back to Moldova, I mean, you do see some kind of increase over time, whereas since 2009, there hasn't really been a big increase. Okay, so how did the voters vote? How did the Moldovan voters vote in the Romanian elections? Well, one thing that's interesting is this is the third highest number of diaspora voters. And I'm not talking about a diaspora in the same sense that I'm not talking about people that have left Romania. These are people who, for all intents and purposes, reside in Moldova and exist as kind of non-resident voters in Romanian elections. And the fact that they are kind of the third largest community of voters, I think, is actually quite interesting and important. And I was quite struck by actually how much support in the first round Ponta was able to get. He came out in top place in the first round, which I thought was interesting. Then in the second round, he loses that edge, and overwhelmingly they follow the diaspora trend towards Iohannis. But I do think it shows that there isn't necessarily stable loyalty when it comes to who Moldovans are voting for in Romanian elections. Even before 2009, they weren't voting for Băsescu, they were voting for Antonescu, yeah, in 2004. So I think there is a kind of game that can be played that's kind of trying to capture this electorate. We don't really know necessarily who they're going to go vote for in the future, and this might dictate some of the messages that we project towards them, which is trying to incentivize them to vote for different candidates. So this is kind of the relationship that I want to talk about now, is how do we go from acquiring Romanian citizenship to becoming voters, and how do Romanian politicians know that this cycle exists? So what I think is quite interesting is the sense of gratitude that comes for the Romanian political class when you acquire Romanian citizenship. So they feel grateful for the politicians that are enabling this right, and at the same time, this kind of sense of duty to give back to the people that they that facilitated this right. And at the same time, I think there's an acute awareness within Romanian politicians that this sense of gratitude exists. And if they can capture that sense of gratitude, then essentially they're also capturing voters. And this came from the interviews that I conducted in 2012 and 2013, where one of the respondents I was talking to said exactly this, that she wanted to give back to the candidate that she was felt had kind of, well, to the political system that she felt had facilitated her right to increase, say, EU travel rights from Romanian citizenship. But at the same time, what I thought was interesting was that at the point of which they gained Romanian citizenship, they didn't actually know that much about kind of Romanian politics. So while they felt this kind of obligation, this wasn't met so much by the information to actually know who they would want to vote for. At the same time, I think what's interesting is an awareness that there is an increasing kind of presence of Romanian politicians, particularly in 2012-2013. Both the PSD and PDLR have opened offices in Chișinău to kind of reach out to voters and also to help them with their citizenship applications. So we see this relationship quite clearly in play between citizenship and voters. And this is something, again, that came across in my interviews. At the same time, even if you feel an obligation to vote, what is quite interesting is there is a constraint on whether you actually will vote, which is how many polling stations there are. So people don't want to vote, people don't want to wait in line to vote. They don't want to queue like 2 or 3 hours, whether it's in London or whether it's in Chișinău. This is something that is constraining people's ability to vote and constraining the likelihood that they would. So I think what will be interesting is to see how many polling stations in the future are opened in Moldova and whether this is kind of pushing up the number of people that actually vote. So this is kind of the cycle of extraterritorial politics that I see, which just kind of goes into more explanation as to the relationship that I'm talking about. This idea that the Romanian political class know that they can kind of capture the votes if they can appear to be facilitating citizenship. And at the same time, this is something that the opposition have also become increasingly aware of, which is interesting when we look at 2014, because Băsescu is no longer the guy that can kind of tap into this system, and he needs to, the new politicians need to be able to kind of capture that existing relationship that was being forged before 2014. And we see this happening. This is taken from a text message that I saw on Facebook, which was sent to my Moldovan electorate. And his response was, well, I don't have Romanian citizenship, so I can't vote. But it's still interesting that there is this quite invasive policy of vote for Ponta, he's for unification, and unity is going to make us stronger. At the same time, I think Iohannis plays a slightly different game. He's not quite so talking about unification, but he is still talking about this strong bond that exists between Romania and Moldova. So the idea that Moldova is kind of the most important country both for the state and for society, and we need to really kind of help Moldova's Europeanisation, which I think fits well with what Roxana is talking about. At the same time, when we see Moldovan elections just yesterday, it's not clear that that's going to be an easy or decisive path for Moldova either. So we kind of, in some ways, see a bit of a tussle between what Romanian politicians want for Moldova and what the Moldovan electorate is kind of willing to participate in that process as well. So where do we go from here? Well, what I think is quite interesting is that when you look at the number of people who are registered on the vote, it's still only about a third of people on the electoral list who are actually participating. So even though we're talking about 36,000 people voting, we could be talking about 100,000 in the future, and we could be even talking about more than 100,000 in future years if there was an increasing number of polling stations. So yeah, where do we go from here? I don't know.
About half an hour for questions, and there are two ways I'd like to run this. The first is I'd like to take rounds of three because we have so many people, just take less time to kind of gather questions. And the second thing is It'd be very important for you to state your name and affiliation. A lot of times people forget to do this. Really, we want to know who you are as well. And if you're directing your question to someone on the panel in particular, do mention that, because we have so many people on the panel that not all of them will be able to respond to everything. So your name and affiliation and rounds of three. And I'll try my best. I'm a bit nearsighted, so if you're in the back especially, raise your hand high, and I'll go with the order that I see people in. Yes.
Can I?
Yes, go ahead and start. Yeah.
Okay. My name is Tudor Mihailescu. I'm a PhD student in international relations at the Graduate Institute of International Development Studies in Geneva. I'm also a co-founder of a social media platform for interaction between citizens and politicians that is Swiss-based and is called GovFaces, and that will be launched at the UK Parliament level in February 2015. I have two questions. One is about continuity and the other one is about change. I'd like to ask the first question to Mr. Chinkoyesh. As you were talking about the different developments in India and during the election campaign, something came to my mind. There was an essay written by Dan Pavel in 2009 that was called Noel System, the New System, and he was talking about the fact that the communist regime managed to nullify all the cleavages that we usually see in a party system, and that the only relevant cleavage is the one between PSD and all its ancestors, PSN and PDSR, and the other parties. This happened all throughout 2008, and that's why he was writing this essay in 2009, announcing the change of the paradigm. And he was saying, now we can see a change in this, and we can see a repositioning on India in the party system. With first of all, it was PSD in an alliance with PDL, and afterwards the parties entering in a coalition against PDL. Paradoxically or not, in 2014 we see that we're coming back to the same paradigm, which is PSD on one side, all the other parties on the other side. First of all, do you believe in the relevance of the paradigm? And if yes, why do you think there is a recurrence and a going back to it? I'd like to address the second question to Mr. Coman. You talked a lot in you mentioned in your presentation the role that social media played, mm-hmm. and this is true. We have a president who is right now the most popular politician in Europe on Facebook. And after this election, Romania is emerging as one of the leaders in the European market when it comes to the use of social media in electoral campaigns and in politics. And I wanted to ask you, do you think social media played a real impact in the outcome of the elections? And is this a true change, or is this just a very shallow difference?
Okay, two more questions. Yes.
Just a short one to Ruxa.
After identifying yourself.
Oh, so Richard Denning, completely unaffiliated.
That's fine.
Question to Roxana. What could you just tell us a little bit more about what is going to stop Johannes achieving what he wants to achieve? And not just the names of the politicians in the company, and things, but behind it. Who are the forces, things that are going to get in the way that can stop them from doing that?
One more question for this round? Yes.
I'm Claire Gordon, the European Institute. I just wanted to follow up from the question that was raised around stability or lack of stability in party systems, and ask if anyone, I don't know if anyone in particular, would like to comment on this, whether they could comment in comparative perspective about what they see going on in Romania vis-à-vis other countries in Central and Eastern Europe. And for example, you spoke about the kind of complete, the sort of seeming demise or at least decline of the left. And we see this in other countries of Central and Eastern Europe, the problem of social democracy in the face of constant austerity. So I wondered if you might be able to, someone could comment on the sort of what we see in Romania in a broader perspective.
Okay, I'll bring up to the panel. And if we can go with those who've been addressed directly first.
Okay. Continuity or change. I must admit I haven't read Dan Pavel's piece from 2009. with the benefit of hindsight, it's easy for me to say, well, there's no chance of any sort of change, what we see of a continuity of paradigm. I think the issue is, and partly I think I'm trying to respond to your question as well, it's not that it's a retreat from the left. It's as a post-communist country, there is some sort of expectation for people to be quite allergic about any sort of idea of the left. However, it's been 25 years and no progress has been made at all in that direction. I think part of the problem is Romania. In Romania is the fact that the left has been kind of colonized by the PSD in its various forms, which is hardly a left-wing party, and that's kind of the main issue. And therefore, any sort of association with the left is sort of immediately conflates the left with the PSD, and that's where sort of things collapse. But because of that sort of conflation has been exploited and has given way to this sort of rejection of any debate about social justice and so on. I suppose, to put it simply, if Ion Iliescu is the person that makes the most sense in the PSD at this point, if that's the case, then we definitely reached rock bottom as far as any debate about the left. And that is highly problematic because there isn't the willingness to engage in debates about left-wing or social justice, social equality-based debates, irrespective of who might do it. Whether Romania's faring worse or not, I'm not too sure. Maybe other people might want to sort of come in on that. But I think there is a tendency for Central and Eastern Europe to show slightly more reticence to the left, which is understandable to some extent. But I think it is being exploited as well significantly, just so that it actually keeps out any debate about that, which I think is deeply, deeply problematic for some of the reasons I've been trying to expose. Sorry.
Okay, thank you for the questions. Do I think social media played a role in the outcome? Does it matter what I think? I think it does. It did. Preliminary data suggests so, but I would not state it outright because I don't know. I can write an essay, but an essay is not empirical evidence, to relate it to what the other thing that was said. About the change of the party system, whether indeed there's the post-communist versus everyone else. I think what characterizes most Eastern European countries is that the left is united. And why I believe that's the case is because the very left is not really an option. The communists are not really popular. It's not cool to be called communist anymore in Eastern Europe or anywhere else to begin with. And I think that's the main advantage of leftist parties. Whereas the right, there are many different families. And in Romania especially, it has been fragmented for a while. I think it goes back to 96, 2000, when the Unia Democrata was a total disaster as a coalition. Not in the sense of what they did, but how they actually got along with each other eventually. So I think the right is simply fragmented. The left is very unified because they started as a really strong bloc with strong networking in the territory, and they still have those networks in place. And just a very brief parenthesis, the main thing that comes out when who's at fault for losing the elections, they already look at what mayors didn't do their jobs. They have to be changed, which is just dumb. Olguța Vasilescu, who's the mayor of Craiova, came out and said, well, people in Cluj don't do their job. That's why people in Cluj don't vote for Social Democrats, which is just ridiculous logic. Sorry.
Just talking about party systems and stability, I mean, one of the things is that it's a very individualistic party system and that people have very little loyalty to their party and are quite happy if there's the offer of the prime ministership or things like this. At various points in time, that Ponsele was mooting Johannes as a potential candidate, mm-hmm. and things like this, and various. So there was lots of points in time whereby people would be willing to switch sides, and nobody really. And if you're going to get promoted or you're going to get a government job, you'll switch sides, and you're not really concerned about your party. And then perhaps once your enemy falls, you can come bouncing back. I think the reason why Anton Escu was so quiet during the election campaign was because he was waiting for Yohannes to fall flat on his face, so he could say, "See, I told you so. You should have picked me instead because I'm Romanian and not German." Also, the other thing that I think there's a paradox about the popularity of Yohannes. Yes, he's got 1 million likes on Facebook, but many people were motivated because they rather vote for Yohannes, rather vote for anybody but Ponta. And this is one of the main problems that he has. I mean, again, in Cluj last week, lots of people said, "Well, I'm on the left, but I didn't want to vote for Yohannes because he's centre-right, but God, anybody but Ponta." And I think, a monkey would have probably, done well with the way Ponta was doing. So.
Anyone else want to weigh in on this round? Yeah? No? Okay. All right, good. Let's go to a second round of questions.
I think I need to answer Richard.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
It's fine.
Trying to keep talking a bit.
Thank you for that. It's a very good point into what exactly is going to stop him. And I was just making a list as I was thinking about it, and I kept coming with more and more issues that could stop him. But I'm going to put this into... I'm going to try and make three categories out of this. We're going back to the eternal question of administrative capacity. And here it's both physical and the money, the people and the money. Because just being enthusiastic about it, he is not going to do it. Obviously, he still needs the time to gather this team that he keeps talking about, this administrative elite that he would like to see in place. And money is still an issue here. Equally important, if not more, is this role of mediator that he wants to have in Romanian politics, this consensus. You do need national consensus for a coherent EU position. And what I'm not clear on at this time is just exactly, it borders on what Dan was saying earlier. I'm not entirely clear exactly who is behind Iohannis at this point, which way political alliances will go. Voters liked him, but not clear if political parties will also stand behind him when it will come to voting. What if we have early elections next year? There are just so many unknowns in this area that it's very problematic to actually say. I think I'm more likely to say it could go really, really bad rather than being tempted to say that it will go all right. And the third one is the EU itself. The way politics is done at the EU level. Some have actually said that Iohannis does not have enough international experience in this area and that it might take a while for him to catch up. On the other hand, neither Ponta nor Băsescu were very popular at the EU level. So when it came to closed-door meetings at the level of the European Council, I'm not very sure they were always where they were supposed to be. So maybe Iohannis will be able to make it there. The cooperation and verification mechanism is still there. Romania is still sort of the bad pupil of the EU, and the EU is the arbiter still. Corruption, I said it already. The incohesiveness of the entire political right, I think it's something. It's definitely a good news, and I would refer to the last question you were asking about a potential comparison. There were a couple of very optimistic voices saying, well, Romania is now an example for the area, especially for Hungary, because look what the voters managed to do. They managed to prevent Ponta from being elected. So, Hungarians, what are you waiting for? So there's a lot of a positive energy for the region. And if he manages, if the political class actually manages to stand up to these expectations, we might see more of that comparative discourse, maybe.
Great. Let's go to a second round of questions now. So Arntan, it'll be very sad.
Could I quickly add to
please
that?
Please do, yeah.
I think the key word, and you have emphasized it a lot, and I think it still boils down to that, is the notion of consensus. And what strikes me about what has happened in the past few years is the complete sort of lack of short-term memory that the electorate seems to be displaying. The same people, or at least large swathes of the same people, protesting against Băsescu a few years ago who were saying anyone would be better than Băsescu have now protested and mobilized against Ponta on the same basis. Anyone would be better than Ponta. And it sounds good on paper what Johannes is proposing and about trying to identify specialists and so on. Again, short-term memory. Someone spoke a few years ago about identifying, was it 15,000 specialists that will... and we know where that went. And I'm vaguely sceptical about that, especially in the context of, you know, as new media has kind of played on quite significantly, the Facebook pictures, post-election pictures, along the lines of, I voted for Johannes, and then Blaga and Răzvan Ungureanu came to tell me that he won, kind of stuff. And that sort of begs significant questions about what's happening in the centre-right. And party system-wise, there seems to be a fragmentation around the centre-right. And there seems to be at least potential for fragmentation, at least reorganisation on the left as well, because the PSD is going at the moment through some sense of turmoil, and I'm sceptical about on whether Ponta will outlive or outmaneuver what's going on currently in the PSD, and that might sort of play out interestingly, at least in the future.
Can I just respond back to PSD? The PSD issue is one that's interesting because I think it's caught in a bind because it's so dependent upon the mayor, you know, the people in Craiova and people like that to deliver the voters and that sort of organisation. Which actually prevents, but they're the problem.
Mm-hmm.
They're both core to it, to its functioning and its electoral success. But they're also the one thing that give it its phenomenal toxicity to the wider electorate.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is again why it hasn't won an election. What hasn't won an election, you know, other than the 2000 election? Can we really count beating Vadi and Tudor as much of a victory? But yeah, you know, it's really
at the time.
But you know. If you're Ponta or you're whoever succeeds Ponta, and you want to move the party on and actually do some kind of reform, you've got to deal with your party barons and all these people who deliver voters and do all the donkey work on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get rid of those, you've got problems.
Well, it's a risky business, right? It's very risky. You do wanna, I don't know, get rid of these methods or gradually move away from the just mobilization on the ground, which is what they do nowadays. None of us have mentioned that it was 4 weeks before the elections they changed the law for mayors. They were allowed to join the PSD, which was a huge deal at the time.
45-day window of opportunity.
Yeah, when they should decide. So exactly for that purpose, because that's how they see things in the PSD. And it's very risky because it's on one hand, it's a very safe vote, right? On the other one, it can actually screw you overall. But eventually, they will have to move away from that. There's no clear social democratic message.
How many times can you sort of suspend John out of these things and actually sell that to the public, I suppose?
Okay. Other hands. Yes.
Daniel Rex, LSC alum, Department of International Relations. There's some discussion around how there was a lack of social policy debate. It was quite a superficial back and forth character election. If you were to want to see any tangible policy change or structural change policy debate in the Romanian environment, what do you think are two or three of the key areas that the system could benefit from having a robust policy discussion about?
Other hands? Yeah.
Roxana Akim, I'm a student in the School of Government at LSE. I have a question for Mr. My question refers to the fact that currently we are witnessing a strong political turmoil in PSD and also about the institution of government in Romania that has been definitely unstable throughout the last 5 years or so. And do you think it would be wise and it would be sane for Romania to witness another government change and Peside to leave or be replaced by someone else, or Ponta be replaced by someone else? Would that be a good option for Romania?
Yes.
Dimitar Berger from the European Institute of LSE. Just a comment about the regional trends. If Romania is following the regional trends, I think you might end up a bit like Poland or Hungary, where the left has basically disappeared and been marginalized, and the main polarization is across the center right. By the way, Bulgaria probably is heading that direction given the profile of the borders of the Socialist Party in the last elections. My question really is, has to do with it's a factual question. And you mentioned party barons and local networks, so I was just wondering how this clientelism and vote mobilization works at the local level. In other words, do we have phenomena like vote buying, corporate votes, captive vote, and how does it work? And what are the variances across Romania?
Good. Let's make this explicit, what you guys were talking about at the end of the last round. So, yes.
Policy debate. It's a tough one, I suppose. But I suppose I deserve it to some extent. The thing that I find most problematic is that no engagement about that emerges from kind of grassroots. Civil society, and that I think is the main problem, because the party system is what it is because of the fragmentation, because of all of these sort of dynamics, it is unlikely to emerge from there, and therefore the other place I would look for would be the grassroots organization, civil society, and this is really the disappointing factor, that nothing is happening in that respect. There's a monopoly by a hugely elitist, patronizing discourse, neoliberal-based discourse. It's not even sort of neoliberal per se, as much as it's sort of it's neoliberalist in form, I suppose. When Patapievich comes up and says, well, lo and behold, there are some people who are actually real communists, and that is a major issue, it's problematic, and these are the trendsetters. It's the half empty part of the glass, but that's the problem. It has to be grassroots, and I suppose it has to be young people to do it. I think a left discourse can emerge out of the environmentalist movement that we've seen recently, and that needs to kind of steer away quite clearly from the attempts to hijack that by the extreme right, on the other hand. So that, if anything, that's where dialogue on these issues is going to emerge from. I don't know whether I'm particularly convincing on that, but it as far as I see it, is quite a bleak picture. As far as the change of Ponta's government goes, I would steer away from making sort of value-laden judgments. It's not about whether it's beneficial for Romania. Again, I'm not sure which Romania we're talking about. We're talking about specific categories, individuals, public image, and so on. I don't think it matters that much. I think we can perpetuate a failing government or change it. And if the choice is to change it, I'm not quite sure change with what. That's the dilemma. There is sort of fragmentation on the right. The PSD there, well, the coalition, the current coalition government has still, I think, a 60%... under 60% majority in the parliament, which, given the Trasez politic and various permutations that might take place in the near future, can go anyway, really. So I don't think there's a better or worse situation. It's about how the future will play out next year, and if not, the year after.
Okay.
Sort of social policy debate. I think the obvious thing would be question, what I would like to see, and one of the things that was interesting was looking at people who were watching, people in Romania who were watching the debates and commenting on Facebook. One of the things was, people are, oh no, now they're talking about the bloody diaspora again, oh it's corruption again, it's the same old thing. Why is nobody talking about questions like inequality? And so I think that there is an awareness that particularly post-crisis that nobody has discussed inequality. Nobody has discussed how, you know, since 2008 inequality has kind of started to increase and things like this, and the gap between urban and rural and between rich and poor and things like this, and that nobody is willing to even discuss it. And there wasn't anything, you know, there was a brief discussion about pensions and how small Johannes's mother-in-law's pension was and things like this, but there wasn't really a big debate about anything like that, and there's nobody who's kind of actually sort of coming forward. I think talking about, you know, the emergence of an alternative left and the environmental movement, the thing that always comes back to is the sense that there are just too many barriers to entry to forming any sort of viable national political movement. When you're dealing with how well organised on the ground the PSD is, the PDL is, the PNL is, in terms of their offices, in terms of their access to media and all these other things, you've got absolutely no chance. I mean, the good example is Dan Nicholsaw in Bucharest, who ran as a sort of environmentalist type candidate and ran a very good campaign and managed to get sort of about 10 or 11%. But that's in Bucharest, where everybody's together. There was a big coalition, and he still struggled, and he still got stabbed in the back by the people who said he wasn't, you know, for various things that he said and so on and so forth. So there seem to be, again, there just seem to be these problems. And again, it's not just incivility and factional politics on the centre-right, there's factional politics on the left as well. And they still can't get together and they still can't agree anything coherent. And so, yeah, I'm even more pessimistic. My glass doesn't have very much in it at all.
Does anyone want to address the comparative issue? So what's going on with mobilising, bringing in the votes, etc.?
I think I thought about something as you asked it. I may be contradicted immediately by your work with the opinion polls, but I suspect in terms of captive audience, the PSD has benefited from that quite significantly, but also there are limits. PSD's captive audience can't win an election. This has been seen in terms of the difference between the first round and the runoff. There was increased participation, and the outcome of the elections rested on the increased participation, because any increased participation would not be benefiting the PSD, because they have pretty much exhausted their capability of mobilizing voters. So the more people turn to vote, the less likely the PSD is to win. So that's about the distribution of voters in terms of the PSD. Trying to think about it and be vaguely coherent, and I think seem to be failing at both at the time at this moment. The other thing is about the absence of linkages. So outside that, I've read some research recently that pointed out that the PSD had the most stable electorate, around 30% of the votes over the past decade or so, which is probably the case. It's also the case that the electoral participation has decreased, and that sort of so the 30% that the PSD has constantly had is on the basis of a decreased participation. So any increase, as we've seen now, results in PSD losing. Everything else is just up for grabs. And at the moment, it was literally, sheerly anti-PSD mobilized, as opposed to in favor of Johannes, or if any other candidate would have made the runoff, would have probably managed to mobilize the same electorate on the same basis.
Anyone wants to raise the question about the fate of the left in Romania compared to other countries? I made it seem like it's a huge victory. It was by comparison to the polls, but I don't think it was that big of a blow for the PSD. And they've been resilient over time. And I don't think something to the extent that it happened definitely in Hungary will happen in Romania. And in Hungary, there were some clear idiosyncratic reason for, like, a lot of scandals, if I remember correctly, corruption, like really big things, even by Romanian standards. We're talking really big things.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think how many members of the PSD get jailed. It's never going to be enough.
No, exactly.
But I think this is the thing. There is this question about the PSD voters and how much, you know, how much are they actually really responding to Ponta's appeals and to the things like, you know, the free, you know, the free salaries and all these other things. Does it? I don't know if anybody has actually really tested whether or not that actually makes PSD voters go out and vote, or whether or not they would vote PSD irrespective. And I think that's one of the things, is that it's something that PSD always does, but does it actually make PSD voters? Or would the PSD voters stay at home if they didn't get their free flour or extra 500 lei in their pension and things like that? And
As I said, I think it's a risky transition. You have something safe. Do you want to reach out to other things? Well, you may actually really lose. It's they're not risk-taking, for sure, so far.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't know how we'd ever know the answer to that question. Because the only way to do it would be to conduct an experiment. And now with the big scandal in political science about experiments in elections, like, how would you ever actually know the answer?
Could you not interview PSD voters and ask them why they voted PSD?
Yeah, no, you could. Probably. I mean, that's my also.
It tells your timing
choice.
Very well.
Yeah, you'd have to time it exceptionally well. I don't know.
Yes and no. The survey that I gave you, Dinko's latest survey, he says that it's social media, etc. But he's actually interviewing people how they voted the first round and how they changed their mind. The numbers that he comes out with just don't match with what happened in the first round at all. Mm-hmm. People say they voted in a different way that they actually did. They just don't make any sense. So it's actually really hard to pan out those things in Romania.
But it was after the first round, there was that thing, was who the hell's voting for Ponte? It wasn't my mother, it wasn't, you know, it was
somebody did vote.
I told my
40% of people voted.
It was like, I told my mother not to vote for Ponte. I told my granny not to vote for Ponte. So somebody else's granny's voting for Ponte and things like that.
He did lose some of his traditional county, so you have to, I mean, it's a valid question to ask. Yeah. What happened there?
We don't have time left, so unfortunately I have to stop taking hands. I want to throw out just one sentence, because I'm the chair and I haven't got to say anything. I really have been struck by how similar this is to Slovakia in 1998, and many of you will just be thinking, what is she talking about? But you had a prime minister who wanted to basically hold on to all the offices, and this old authoritarian tactics being used in a massive generation divide where you have these kinds of discussions. I told my granny not to vote for Mechar. And I'm just wondering if the future looks something like we have in Slovakia, which, you know, still fragmented, really. But that's what makes these places interesting. So I'm not as pessimistic. I am American, so I can't be as pessimistic as American. But really, Romania is so fascinating, and I don't think that politics ever gets sort of as organized as maybe some of us might be hoping it would get anywhere. So with that said, I would like you to all join me in thanking our panelists.